Collective Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Two working groups have been formed, one to draft a list of measures that need to be taken by Iran, and another to outline the sanctions that have to be removed by the US. Now, a third expert group will be working on the matter of sequence. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, said that would be the focus of talks when they resume next week.
Next week, the important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures, and we have now focused more on the question of sequence to make sure that the U.S., who has left the JCPOA, should come back first, should lift all its sanctions first, and then Iran would follow after the verification.
Although no direct talks have taken place between Iran and the U.S., the American delegation has been engaged in discussions with the other parties, including Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China.
The top priority remains to focus on sanction lifting. In this particular context, the U.S. must lift all its sanctions, may it concern Iran or any third party, in thorough, complete, and straightforward manner.
Before leaving Vienna for Tehran, Araghchi said Iran does not want to prolong the negotiations, but also needs to take the time to work on every single word that's being drafted to come up with a specific formula allowing both Iran and the U.S. to come back to full compliance. Iran says the talks are on the right track and moving forward, but as the EU coordinator put it, there's still a lot of work to be done. Pomalinsky, Vienna.
Tensions between the United States and Russia appear to be ratcheting up in recent weeks over a range of issues, including Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry on Tuesday accused the U.S. and NATO of engaging in what it described as provocative activities in the waters and airspace of the Black Sea. Moscow also accused Kiev of trying to destabilize the situation in the eastern Donbass region. Amid escalating tensions, Washington and its NATO allies have rallied behind Kiev. They voiced concern over Russia's troop deployment along its borders with Ukraine, claiming Russia might be planning to invade the country. But Moscow said the military buildup was in response to cold, threatening military action by NATO and nothing more. Washington-Moscow tensions heightened after the U.S. administration announced a new array of anti-Russia sanctions last Thursday. The White House claimed the sanctions were in retaliation for a range of Russia's actions, including its alleged meddling in the U.S. election, cyber espionage, and action in Ukraine. The Kremlin responded with tit-for-tat measures. But the hostile attitude of the U.S. and its allies is not limited to Russia. They have also collectively formed and launched a pressure campaign against China. Just last month, the U.S., along with the European Union, Britain, and Canada, imposed coordinated actions on Beijing under the pretext of human rights violations. The United States and China have also been embroiled in disputes over a host of issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. Beijing has time and again accused Washington of seeking to destabilize mainland China by interfering in the affairs of Hong Kong and Chinese Taipei, as well as fomenting tensions in the South China Sea. The country last week escalated its military activities after the U.S. announced it would deploy its warships to the region. The Chinese president on Tuesday also criticized the hegemonic power structures in the global governance, calling for the rejection of such moves.
The future of the world should be mastered by all countries in the world. Rules made by a single country or just a few countries cannot be forcibly applied on others. The world order cannot be led by unilateralism from some country.
The growing tension between Washington on the one side and Moscow and Beijing on the other is bringing the two countries even closer. U.S. President Joe Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington thinks is a threat to its global interests.
Northern Ireland is bracing itself for more potential trouble. Peaceful pop-up protests across the region in the coming days. An opportunity, some say, to catch police by surprise and block major roads for a time. They follow days of riots and violent clashes earlier this month that plunged the city of Belfast and parts of Northern Ireland into a crisis not seen since the dark days of the Troubles that started in the late 1960s and led to nearly three decades of bloodshed.
There will be protests around the north of Ireland, but what's worrying is that there's a lot of disinformation also. What we're seeing here is a hidden hand and trying to raise tensions between the Catholic and Protestant communities. And when we see this, these things happening, we always have to remember that when there's a void, there, extremists fill that void. And when the extremists are there to fill that void, we always see the hidden hand of British security services.
Tensions have been rising since Brexit, which many warn would threaten the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 that put an end to the Troubles. The implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol allowed the UK to leave the EU without setting up a border on the island of Ireland. Instead, the UK and EU agreed to a customs border between Britain and Northern Ireland. Now, the loyalist and unionist communities who wish to remain under British rule are demanding the protocol be scrapped.
This would have seriously destabilized the peace and brought us back to somewhere that was pre-1998 and something that we as a society didn't want to see.
The riots were also fueled by the country's police chief's refusal to resign after a decision not to prosecute Sinn Féin politicians for attending a large funeral last year against COVID restrictions.
I don't see why Simon Byrne would have resigned. I think that he gave his report to those that would have made that decision within the PPS. And, you know, once he has passed that on, there's not much he can do after that. He made recommendations.
Efforts are underway for a political settlement of tensions, including a call for dialogue among all sides from the U.S. president. Still, fears of more unrest and violence are in the air. Saeed Bouriza, London.
The EU's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, updated the bloc's 27 foreign affairs ministers on the latest state of play regarding talks in Vienna to try and save the Iran nuclear deal. He told them that discussions have become less general and more focused, particularly regarding US sanctions against Iran and the Islamic Republic's nuclear energy program.
I talked with Secretary of State Blinken last week when he was in Brussels. I also talked with Minister Sharif. I think that both parts are really interested in reaching an agreement.
Borrell talks about an agreement, but critics say the EU has been much too soft on the US. After all, an agreement was reached in 2015. It was endorsed by the UN. Only the US broke the terms of the accord when Donald Trump took Washington out of the deal almost 3 years ago.
With Iran, we'll see what happens.
Analysts say in those 3 years, the EU, as coordinator of the deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, failed to stand up to Trump. Representatives from Iran, Russia, China, France, Britain, Germany, and the European Commission are attempting to preserve the accord during negotiations in the Austrian capital. US officials are there on the sidelines of the talks. Given that the nuclear deal is underpinned by UN Resolution 2231, the vast majority of diplomats agree it should be respected.
We are 193 member states of the United Nations. Of course, the United States, as you've rightly pointed out, is a powerful member state, but they are a member state. And so we need to rally the numbers against those that may have different opinions.
Some citizens we've been talking to say Tel Aviv is behind efforts to derail the nuclear agreement.
Israel have interest and Israel are kind of pushing America.
Frankly, what we need is more peace and not more warmongering.
Tehran insists the only way the issue can be resolved is if Washington lifts all of its illegal sanctions. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Has imposed more tight restrictions to fight the spread of the coronavirus. Earlier, Turkish president said that the daily lockdown during the first 2 weeks of the holy month of Ramadan will start at 7 p.m. instead of 9 p.m. The lockdown will last till 5 a.m. every day, as the weekend lockdown will continue with stricter measures and more police officers present in the streets to make sure citizens and residents are abiding by the rules. During the weekend, security forces in all 81 provinces were out to make sure people are not violating the lockdown. Tourists are the only ones allowed to be outside during the lockdowns. In Istanbul alone, some 20,000 policemen took part in this campaign. Turkish Interior Minister threatened to punish those who do not respect the rules.
We will be out with our full force. Foreigners with residency permits are also subjected to restrictions and lockdowns, and they have to obey the rules just like others. I have the authority to revoke the residency permits of those who try to exploit the situation, pretending to be tourists. We will not let this happen.
The death toll in Turkey surged last month when restrictions were relaxed. Some blame the people who didn't act responsibly. Others blame the government for taking decisions based on the economic needs of the country rather than what is better for people's health. Analysts believe the government must take stricter measures. However, it is the economic situation that is preventing it from doing so.
The government is doing its best against the pandemic, but unfortunately the cases are rising because the country cannot afford full closure of businesses. Therefore, semi-closure is the only solution, and people must be more responsible.
Turkish Health Ministry said 20 million vaccine jabs have been distributed across the country. This is as Turkey says it has potentially developed a vaccine that just entered the phase of human trials. Turkish Industry and Technology Minister Mustafa Varank has volunteered for the trials. Turkish government wants to welcome tourists again after the holy month of Ramadan. However, many believe it is still too soon for this step, as only 25% of citizens have been vaccinated. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
After mass scenes of a failed security operation against thousands of protesters demanding the expulsion of French ambassador from Pakistan, the public resentment pitched high when the police launched operation against the protesters in the eastern city of Lahore. At the heart of public outrage is the revoking of a 6-month-old agreement by the government with Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan, or the TLP, a political and religious group. The TLP championed the cause to expel French ambassador over repeated incident of blaspheming of Muslim Prophet Muhammad and their official patronage by the French government. The TLP supporters allegedly attacked a police station in Lahore and kidnapped 11 policemen, including senior official. Later on, the protesters released all the police officials. The police says an oil tanker with over 50,000 liters of fuel was also taken away by the protesters, which caused ripples within the corridors of power of its possible explosion. A strong public reaction once again forced the government to halt its security operation. There were countrywide wheel jam strike and closure of businesses after many opposition parties and other religious groups announced to support the TLP's demand to expel French ambassador.
How long we would put up with incidents like burning of Holy Quran? How long we would put up with blasphemy being committed against our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him? But now we have decided not to tolerate it any longer.
Alarmed by public backlash, Prime Minister Imran Khan struggled hard in his live address to the nation to calm down public anger.
When Muslim countries stand up together and collectively boycott trade with France over blasphemy incidents, then it would have an impact. I would lead this campaign internationally now to prevent incidents of blasphemy.
Pakistan banned TLP last week, declaring it a terrorist organization in a country where violence against the police has become a norm by almost all major political parties to press their demands.
The government has resumed negotiation with the TLP, which is not ready to settle down on anything short of the expulsion of French ambassador from Pakistan. Now the TLP seems to be on a far more strong footing after a failed security operation against them. Therefore, analysts believe that the government is also running out of options but to withdraw its decision to ban it. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The factory in the south of Tehran, where a new vaccine named Osvid would be produced within a few months to immune people against the deadly coronavirus. The name is taken from the pharmaceutical company that is developing the vaccine in collaboration with a knowledge-based firm. The joint project will soon be tested on humans to be mass-produced in the capital, Tehran.
Given that the initial phases of the Osvid 19 are completed and the early stages, including the animal phase, were carried out on rats and monkeys successfully, we need to launch this mass production line, and now we are prepared.
I asked the officials whether the formula is imported from other countries or it is indigenous, and this was the answer.
Not even a single word of the 420-page project of the vaccine has been non-native. It's fully developed in Iran. We took samples from the first patients at the beginning of the pandemic. Then it was characterized, inactivated, and cultivated. The job has been a very complicated teamwork and totally indigenous.
Right now, the company is producing the vials, and as the manager said, they can produce up to 6,000 every hour. They also told us that there is a capacity to produce about 20 million doses of the jab in a year. After the official ceremony in which the vial was unveiled, the vice president for science and technology launched the production line.
Within the past few years, very good things have been achieved in the domain of vaccine production in the country. This year, we have several corona vaccines to be mass-produced. This vial production line is a very important infrastructure for other companies that are developing the vaccine.
The Osvid vaccine must be injected in two stages with a three-week interval.
Iran says the second phase of vaccination against COVID-19 will begin in early May, and at this stage, about 15 million people would be vaccinated against the coronavirus. To this end, the country needs about 30 million doses of the vaccine, out of which a great number will be homemade ones. Fuman Abedi, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything? Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the motto of France is freedom, liberty, and fraternity. Many French would say that there is a major gap in the slogan of the country and reality on the ground for its people. This as the French National Assembly has passed a new security law giving police even more power. One of the most controversial parts of the law prohibits the sharing of images of police with malicious intent. Now, critics say it is vague and can be used to stifle freedom and initiate a more severe crackdown. We're going to start off this discussion crossing over to Paris, joined by correspondent there, Chris DeHaan. Chris, well, fill us in. and what this law could mean.
Well, concretely, this law means certainly a limitation of individual and public liberties. So the police impunity will increase, that's for sure. Police powers are increasing, that's for sure. Now it will be interesting to investigate the exact degree of the limitation of these freedoms, because France is still not a police state. There are still democratic institutions functioning, political parties, associations, trade unions are working. But it's not sure in what kind of degree, in what degree demonstrations, for instance, will be allowed in the near future. So it's certainly a limitation of public liberties, but we are not yet in a dictatorship.
And let me get our next guest in too on this, independent journalist, if I have him, out of Marseille, Sylvain Marcadia. Your take on this, in your opinion, why has the Macron government pushed for this? They were very aggressive in wanting to make sure this legislation gets passed.
Yes, it's a good question. Like, I really believe that the party in power, Macron's party, La République En Marche, is trying to attract voters who would vote for the far-right party, Rassemblement National, headed by Marine Le Pen. So this move that is basically supporting the actions of the police, supporting the impunity of the police, is a move to attract these conservative votes in favor of Macron for the coming elections next year. So I do believe that this is one of the objectives. The other is also to reassure the police in a moment where it is becoming like a key element of the French institutions. Like the public opinion is more and more engaged against the government. We've seen the Yellow Vest movement erupting a few years ago, a few months after Macron was elected and after his first policies. And this is a way to support, reassure the police in their actions against these movements that are opposing the power, the party in power, I believe.
Okay, let me welcome my next guest out of Paris, journalist and geopolitical analyst, Gerard Coleman. Gerard, good to have you with us. Your take on exactly what this means now. I mean, has France transitioned? Is it leaning more and more to the right and just continually trying to limit individual freedom? Because we see this particular law, the security law. We also have seen the separation law. Your assessment of what is going on in general in the country?
Well, it's been leaning to financial rights since the 1968, really, when the Rothschild Bank took over, particularly in the 1970s. So the trajectory of French politics from the late 60s to now has been towards the extreme financial right. Socially, in terms of social mores, the regime in place is essentially a consequence of 1968. So that's what goes for the left today. I don't really know what you would call that in terms of right or left. But I think the reality is that we have a police state, and now they're giving police full powers. So we have a situation where drones, for example, can go into people's houses. Police can use drones. They did use them in the lockdown last year. They used drones in different parts of the country. But that caused controversy. I mean, it was a lot of people opposed to the idea of being followed around by drones, police drones. Now it will give police those kind of powers. We did see massive police brutality and repression during the Yellow Vest uprisings. We've seen massive police brutality right throughout the lockdown period over the last year. Just the other day in Paris, people were hunted out of parks and hunted out of the Seine area where people used to have picnics. People are not allowed to live effectively anymore in France, and that's not an exception, that's all over Europe. It is illegal to meet people, it is illegal pretty much to do anything other than go to work, wear a mask, and so on, and come home. So what it means is that it basically gives police now possibility of following you around the drone, openly surveilling the whole population. And also, you know, private life is gone. They can legally go into your home. They have some suspicion about you. Now, suspicion about you might be that you're not wearing a mask in your home. If they make that the next law, which they could, because they're pretty much most of the time now here, when you read the newspapers, every day a new law is being passed, which takes away some other fundamental human liberty. So they spend most of their time discussing what liberty they're going to take away next. And so if you were to look at Paris now, particularly since the attacks in 2015-16, the series of terrorist attacks, it's police state, there's police everywhere. And, you know, if you compare it to so-called totalitarian countries, let's say like Iran, and I've been there many times, you don't see the same police concentration in the streets. This is a police state, and of the police. If you ask here about the mask issue, for example, wearing masks in the street in Paris, I mean, some people believe in that and they comply, but a lot of people don't like being forced to do things. And most people I've spoken to said they wear them because they fear the police. Mm-hmm. So that you have a situation where people live in fear of police all the time. Generally, the population in France is really very, very sick of fines. They get fined for living here.
Okay.
Speeding fines, because you've got these, you know, with the sort of Internet of Things coming in, everything is being surveilled. So, you know, you've got sensors everywhere picking everything up. Now you're going to have biometric cameras. So, you know, that means essentially you're under surveillance all the time. And,
okay. Stay with me, Gerard. Let me get Sylvain back in this discussion. Sylvain, you heard what Gerard was saying. Do you think that the majority of French people actually support these new security measures?
I don't think so. No, I really do not believe they do.
So why has the French Assembly? I mean, they're supposed to be representatives of the French people. So what has happened that this legislation then has been passed?
Well, this probably has to do with like the French particularity in politics, that even though politicians get like elected and voted for, they seldomly respect their promises once they get into power. Macron was never elected to vote these laws. Actually, there are many parts of his program that he never applied or delayed. And he has used the COVID-19 crisis very conveniently for this. And this is basically, yes, like the reason why the Assembly managed to vote this law. And I generally also believe that the establishment, the political establishment that voted this law is afraid, has learned the lessons from the Yellow Vest movement, feared for the stability of their well-being and everything, and they are ready to ensure that the status quo, like the Fifth Republic as we are we call our institutions, are going to be maintained. And that actually have many issues that should be discussed in order to eventually come out of this system that is very vertical in terms of power, gives a lot of power to the president, and amongst other many other issues. But the representative system of France has issues that should be addressed instead of giving more rights to repress demonstrators and people opposing the police, which is actually a fundamental right.
Okay.
To demonstrate. That this is a right that's being denied little by little, as mentioned.
Okay, well, Gerard, where does the press fit in here? I mean, will they be able to show images from the scene of demos when police are involved, or where do you see things going from that perspective?
Well, the press is a system of state propaganda in all Western countries, and it's always been like that. So the press the press is the state, really. There isn't a separation. There's very little criticism allowed of state policy in the press. The press is there as a communication device of the state. So it's not going to affect the working of journalists, because they mostly publish fake news anyway. And the demonstrations that will be allowed, the demonstrations that will take place, will be demonstrations which are state-sponsored. So, for example, climate change demonstrations are given full support of the state, full support of the banks and the corporations. Gay pride is fully supported by the corporations and banks of the state. All these kinds of demonstrations will be promoted, but real demonstrations will not be allowed, and we're going to see a criminalization of the type of Gilets Jaunes protests, the anti-mask protests, the anti-forced vaccine protests. There haven't been many in France in comparison to other countries, but this will make it more difficult for people with real issues, real life issues, to demonstrate. And the press doesn't cover those issues anyway, so they're not going to be concerned about the repression of the real dissidents in the country. We've just seen a dissident released from prison today. Hervé Vessel was put in prison because of his writings, and so now we have political prisoners in France, and we have more prison sentenced prominent dissident intellectuals, and that's the future. They're actually emptying a lot of the prisons. They're letting prisoners, actual criminals, go, and they're filling them with political dissidents. And that is the future right now.
Well, Sylvain, now officials say that the law is needed to protect law enforcement officers. Your take on that side of things, what do you think?
I'll use a quote from David Dufresne, who is a French journalist who has been writing extensively on the Yellow Vest movement and on issues of global security in France and freedom of speech. And he was calling this law Orwellian, even in its name, global security. What security are we talking about? Are we talking about the security of the citizens, or are we talking about the security and impunity of the law enforcement forces? So obviously there is an issue with these laws, and they are definitely not a move in favor of freedom of speech. They are actually a deterrent for independent journalists to engage in their work and to document the actions of the police. The issue here is police brutality. The issue is not security of police officers. There have been so many cases of police violence documented by citizens in the streets, and this is what the police and Gérald Darmanin, the Ministry of Interior, are trying to go against with this law that is basically giving this impunity and preventing citizens of doing their work, which is to report police violence and other actions during demonstrations.
Well, Gerard, we've also witnessed so many different laws. One of them is the separation law in France, where Muslims have been the target. We're just seeing more and more and more laws that seem to be weeding away the rights of the people in France. I'm just wondering about the French people in general. The French people have more of a love for independence and individual freedom. Why aren't we seeing more of a reaction? We have seen some demonstrations, but do you think that we're going to see increased outward show of being upset to this new law by the French people, or have they just learned to acquiesce and accept it?
There's two points there. You mentioned the Muslims and then the French love of liberty, and I think one on the Muslim issue. The police in France are highly integrated with the Israeli Defense Forces, Mossad, even Israeli militia like Betar, who are banned, are so extreme they're banned in Israel. They have links to the French police. So that will explain focus as well on Muslims, because the constant obsession about Muslims in France, the danger and so on, and then many very suspect terrorist attacks and of course a catastrophic foreign policy. None of that is ever discussed in the debate. So that, you know, that is that explains why you have the repression of the Muslim community. But on the other issue of the general love of liberty, well, it's a farce. You know, Republican liberty has been a farce from the very start because it's not based on any solid philosophy. It's based on a false theory of the human being, and it's based on 18th century Enlightenment ideas, which are false ideas, and we're seeing the consequence of that now. When you get that kind of republic, eventually you have to pass laws against every fundamental liberty. So it makes a farce of the whole idea of liberty in the first place. And so we're seeing the collapse, essentially, of the principles of the French Revolution. But in the context where those principles are becoming the principles of a global government system. So, you know, France is part of a much wider agenda here. Europe and the world is going through the same process. There is a specificity in France, of course, which is the French love of liberty. But the we haven't seen any manifestation of that in the last year. If you compare France, for example, to Germany, millions of people have demonstrated against the lockdown in Germany. They demonstrated against the pseudoscience promoted by the media and so on and so forth. There's been very little of that in France. So I think...
Why is that the case?
One of the reasons, I would say, is that the French were simply worn out and demonstrated with the Yellow Vest. I mean, you had the Yellow Vest movement just galvanized, it just, you know, mobilized thousands of people for, 2 years? It just went on and on and on and on. It went nowhere. And in a way, I think it sort of it exhausted an awful lot of people. And then after that, with the coronavirus, they were kind of taken by surprise. But I also think it's the French are very brilliant media propagandists, and they have a much more sophisticated propaganda system than any other country I know. They are very good at preempting counter arguments and preempting counter movements. They do it better than most of the countries. So last year, you compare the Anglophone media to the French media. French have been very good at sort of at basically dividing and conquering the French elites, that is. And I think that's one of the reasons they basically, you know, you have a far-right party, sort of called far-right party, which is in bed with the Zionists, has not really had, you know, made any significant opposition to the Macron regime in the last year. Could have had many opportunities to come out and be the hero of people, open everything up and put the bad guys in jail. Marine Le Pen is completely sold out. And we're seeing that with a lot of the far-right parties in Europe, so-called far-right parties, that they are basically going along with the technocratic agenda. And they're not coming out on the side of the people. So that's another reason that you have extreme manipulation on the right and on the left here. And, you know, that there's no coherent view of opposition that can unite the opposition to put an end to this. Because you have to see that a lot of these agendas are linked. You know, a police state giving police almost absolute powers, and then a lockdown situation, a medical dictatorship, forced vaccination, et cetera, et cetera. They're all linked. They're all part of the takeover of society by another. You know, we need to understand that that transcends class, race, and a lot of other issues that divide people. This is what is happening is that the wealthiest people in the world have taken over the world. They've taken over pretty much every state in the world. And okay. You know, France is an example of a country where they've done this to a very extreme extent, and they've managed to do it without much opposition until now. Because they have, they've been studying techniques of propaganda, I think, better than any other country.
Okay. And on that note, I'd like to thank my guests for being with us. We're out of time in this debate. Join us on geopolitical analyst Gerald Coleman out of Paris and out of Marseille, independent journalist Sylvain Mercadier.
Thank you.
Thank you. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The jury's guilty verdict on the former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin for killing George Floyd signaled the conclusion of a historic police brutality trial, and a key moment for policing and for the battle for racial equality in America. Observers have talked about this case being so significant that it will stand as a watershed between the way law enforcement was held to account in the United States before George Floyd was pinned by the neck under Derek Chauvin's knee, and after. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Joanna Walters. The piece is titled, "Will the Derek Chauvin Guilty Verdict Change Policing in America?" Stay with us for more of Joanna Walters' article. Jury's guilty verdict on the former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin for killing George Floyd signaled the conclusion of a historic police brutality trial, and a key moment for policing and for the battle for racial equality in America. Observers have talked about this case being so significant that it will stand as a watershed between the way law enforcement was held to account in the United States before George Floyd was pinned by the neck under Derek Chauvin's knee, and after. From the time bystander video of that drawn-out death, as George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, begged for his life whilst Derek Chauvin, who is white, looked defiantly into the camera, two major things shifted. First, the Black Lives Movement, already battling for an end to disproportionate police killings of black people and for justice and equity, drove a massive new civil rights uprising that spread from Minneapolis across the United States and internationally. It inspired marches and largely peaceful protests coast to coast, from small towns in rural areas to America's biggest cities. And the demonstrations expanded to include other deaths of defenseless black people at the hands of police or racist agitators. People such as Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Philando Castile, Walter Scott, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, and so many others in the recurring American tragedy. The impetus rippled to other countries, where marches were held in many cities to mark local police killings, as well as those in the United States, and Black Lives Matter became an international rallying cry. And to some extent, into US culture more broadly, so that managements were urged to examine or accelerate long overdue efforts to address entrenched white privilege that perpetuates a poisonous lack of diversity in corporations and organizations. But especially in relation to law enforcement in the United States, people started asking how the egregious police killings were going to stop unless policing itself was fundamentally reformed, up to the point of entirely defunding and abolishing police departments and rethinking how cities should administer public safety, public order, and care. Second, vital chunks of the traditional so-called blue wall of silence, where police departments harbor one of their own after wrongdoing and fend off demands for accountability, crumbled. After Medaria Arredondo, the Minneapolis police chief, saw the viral bystander video of George Floyd's death, things moved quickly. Arredondo publicly called Floyd's killing a murder. He fired and had arrested Derek Chauvin and the three other police officers who were involved in violently arresting Floyd on suspicion of the misdemeanor of using a fake $20 bill in a Minneapolis corner store. And then he was one of the star witnesses for the prosecution at Derek Chauvin's murder trial, among a string of serving Minneapolis police officers who testified against their former colleague. Medaria Arredondo, the first black police chief in the history of Minneapolis, had previously sued the department for discrimination when he was struggling to rise through the ranks. Arredondo told the jury he vehemently disagreed with Derek Chauvin's actions. The officer had in no way, shape or form followed regulations or training policies and had shown a disregard for police principle to respect the sanctity of life. Even if part of the motivation was to scapegoat Derek Chauvin whilst trying to show how the department had made improvements, it is still rare for a police chief to acknowledge and eject a killer cop, see them prosecuted, and then testify against them. And the police department looked bad anyway, because Derek Chauvin had worked there for 19 years and had had numerous complaints about brutality made against him whilst escaping the consequences. So the level of transparency and accountability demonstrated during the Chauvin case was notable. Despite assertions at the trial's opening that it was about one police officer and one case, it was clear from the start that U.S. policing, and as Floyd's relatives said themselves, America itself was on trial. The United States has a sprawling, decentralized system of policing. The country has roughly 18,000 police departments, each with their own use of force policy, hiring practices, and oversight mechanisms, making universal reform near impossible. And the Trump administration certainly sent limited progress towards reform hurtling backwards. There has been no revolution in racial justice or policing in the United States since George Floyd was killed on 25th of May 2020. A vote in Minneapolis last June to create a process to replace the police department with a new system of public safety and accountability, for example, soon ran into difficulty, and frustration across the country is legion. But there has been progress, and George Floyd's terrible death reverberated so comprehensively around the world that even if there are setbacks or slow marching by conservatives, the direction is definitely forward.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English.